It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Say the word Watergate, and it brings to mind many things. It describes a building, a break-in, a cover-up, congressional investigations, televised Senate hearings, enterprise journalism, and an historic transfer of power. So what is the legacy of all that? Tonight, the University of Pittsburgh looks at that question with a panel of insiders during a discussion titled Watergate, Third-Rate Burglary, or Historical Turning Point. During the first part of today's program, I'm joined in Studio A by a couple of those insiders, including my first guest, Alexander Butterfield, the late President Nixon's deputy assistant. He's the man who told Capitol Hill investigators that President Nixon had been taping Oval Office conversations. The revelation sparked a series of events that led to President Nixon's eventual resignation. Mr. Butterfield was a decorated Air Force pilot before joining the Nixon administration. Alexander Butterfield, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
And if you have a comment or question for our guest, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Alexander Butterfield, how did you end up going to work as President Nixon's deputy assistant?
That's a long story. I'll make it very brief. And incidentally, call me Alex. I'm Alexander in a formal sense or on paper, but everyone calls me Alex.
All right. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. I started to say I was in a bar. That's not right. I was I was in New Guinea in Port Moresby in a rainstorm, and I read in the paper, the local paper there is called the Talk Talk. T-O-K-T-O-K, and it's all in pidgin. It's a little hard to discern the English from the pidgin. But I read that Bob Haldeman was the new going to be the top man in the President Nixon transition team, which was conferring in New York rather than in Washington. The transition, Nixon wanted his transition to be in New York City at the Pierre Hotel. That was the headquarters. And I was trying to get out of Australia. I was stationed there as the senior U.S. military officer, and I loved the duty, but it was not the place to be if you were ambitious U.S. Air Force officer. And I'd been there 2 years already. And so I was trying to find a way to get back to the United States. And here I'm reading about my old friend, Bob Haldeman from UCLA, is going to be the top man in the Nixon administration. So I wrote him a letter. I did initiate this thing and asked if I could meet him. I went to the Pierre Hotel in New York a week later and had a great meeting with him. December of 1968. Nixon had just won the election the month before. And I had not seen Bob Haldeman since 1946. I went to UCLA immediately after World War II. But our wives had kept in touch, so there was some connection there. And I had worked quite a bit in the Johnson White House as a military assistant to the Secretary of Defense, McNamara. I was his military assistant for White House matters. So I spent, without exaggerating, I guess a good 20 hours a week in the Johnson White House. And I'd worked in war plans in the Pentagon and McNamara's office. So I think Haldeman saw, and everybody that he was going to bring in were all these California guys. Nobody had had any duty in Washington before, with the possible exception of Henry Kissinger, who'd been a consultant. And I think it made sense to him, and it certainly made sense to me. So I didn't hear from him for a long time, about a month, but it was mid-January when I got the call. And I was going there in a military capacity, and he said, we're going to put you in as my deputy. I didn't think I'd need one, but you and I will be the sole people working with the president. And it's very important that he like you, because if he doesn't, you're out of here.
What duties did you perform for the president?
Well, essentially, shortly after I went to work there, the president moved me into Bob's office and moved Bob into a huge office down the hall, but I had that very beautiful office that adjoins the Oval Office on the west side. Subsequent presidents have made it into a little dining room or a library type of thing. I'm not sure what it is today. At any rate, being there, I was very close to Richard Nixon, first to see him in the morning, last to see him in the evening. And my main responsibility was the smooth running of his official day, even if that official day was out at the Western White House in San Clemente or in Washington. Camp David and Key Biscayne were recreational places, and business was seldom done there, but the Western White House in Washington. And that was my main job, to see that everything ran smoothly.
Now, while working in the White House, one of your duties was overseeing a system that made recordings of conversations in the White House. Whose idea was it? Who put the system in, and how did it work?
Well, first of all, that's been dramatized. Overseeing, someone said I was in charge of internal security, that sort of thing. No, one day I was the liaison with the Secret Service and the FBI between the president and those two services. And so it would be natural that to set up a system like that, a listening device system, as expansive as they wanted it to be. It was quite sophisticated, really. They would come to me. So they just said, the president wants listening devices in the Oval Office on certain telephones, in his office, in the executive office building across the street, in the Lincoln sitting room upstairs, and then later out in Camp David, in his cabin. So
listening devices and recording devices.
Just listening devices, yes, which were recorded.
Uh-huh.
That's right. So I went to the chief of the technical security division of the Secret Service. Most of us think of the protective division, but they have a technical security division, whose name was Al Wong, and I just relayed the message. That's all I did. I know nothing about security myself. I'm not trained that way. But so, as I say, it's been dramatized over the years that I was this security chief. So Wong said, okay, we understand. We'll put it in. I didn't know at the time that they'd done this before.
Who besides you knew it existed?
I think seven people. Haldeman, who's the one who told me to do it. He told me through Higbee, and then later he and I discussed it at great length. Higbee was his staff assistant. So Haldeman, his staff assistant, Higbee, the president, because he's the one who ordered it in, and myself, that's four. And then I went to Al Wong, and he had three technicians put it in. So that's five and three is eight people knew about it. And about a year later, I was allowed by Haldeman to tell my secretary.
And what was to be done with all those tapes? What were they going to do with them?
Well, no one spelled it out, but it was pretty clear. Nixon was sort of nuts about, psycho about retaining things for history, for posterity, and that really meant for the Nixon Library. And prior to the installation of those listening devices, we had someone sit in on every meeting and take didn't write notes because that would intimidate the visitor, but make mental note of the atmosphere in the meeting, Nixon's mood, and essentially purpose of the meeting and what went on. So we had those. Those were called memos for the president's file. And we didn't have 100% cooperation, but people were supposed to turn those in within 24 hours to me. So now along come the listening devices in roughly, I think, the spring of 71. And but we retained the other system. So we had two systems going to catalog everything that happened in the Oval Office.
As the Watergate investigation got going, what concerns did you have about the discovery of the existence of the tapes?
Well, really, I had none. And let me add this. The president acted as though he were completely oblivious to the tapes. You know, they did not intimidate him at all, as the tapes proved when they've come out. But that seemed odd to me. But I think he put complete faith in those few people who knew about it. And it worked, too, for, well, what, from spring of 71 all the way up to, well, that isn't very far, is it? Mid-73, when I happened to be called before the Watergate Committee and asked that question.
Right. By the summer of 73, after Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein wrote a series of articles looking at who was behind the Watergate break-in, the investigation heats up on Capitol Hill. You were interviewed by the staff of the U.S. Senate Select Committee, prior to going before the senators. How reluctant were you to testify about this?
Well, I wasn't at all reluctant to go before that committee. If I had known they were going to even touch on the subject of tapes, I would have been intimidated, and I'm not sure what I've done. I've probably complied, because not to comply, not to go up there and be interviewed by the committee would, I don't know, that would impart some mysterious message, would it not? And we'd all been interrogated many times before. The FBI had us, we were interrogated. The special prosecutor's office, very young then, Richard Benvenisti, and his gal pal, who was also a prosecutor, Jill Vollmer. Now her name is Jill Winebanks. I think she's going to be on our panel this evening.
She is indeed.
And they interrogated everybody quite thoroughly. The Justice Department interrogated us. So being interrogated didn't intimidate me at all. And usually the reason they wanted to interrogate me was to learn what went on in the inner sanctum, who does what to whom, what are the relationships, aide to president and aide to aide, that type of thing. So I didn't mind going up there, but I had no idea that tapes would be the topic. And I learned that immediately. That was the first question they asked.
And we're going to talk more about that and also listen to what happened when you went before the full committee in a nationally televised session of those famous Watergate hearings back in 1973. It's Essential Pittsburgh. Our guest is Alexander Butterfield, deputy assistant to President Nixon, who told Capitol Hill investigators that the president had been taping conversations. We'll continue our conversation with him as Essential Pittsburgh returns on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Alexander Butterfield, deputy assistant to President Nixon, who told Capitol Hill investigators that the president had been taping conversations. And also joining us a little later for this segment, Tim Naftali, former director of the Richard M. Nixon Library and Museum. They are both taking part in a discussion tonight at the University of Pittsburgh called Watergate, Third-Rate Burglary or Historical Turning Point. The audience is already booked to capacity, but you can find a link to a live webcast by going to our website at WESA.FM. When we took the break, we were talking about the point at which you were about to be called up to Capitol Hill to testify in front of the full committee in a nationally televised session on July 16th, 1973. What, at that point, had you decided you were willing to tell these senators, Alex Butterfield?
Well, I was willing to tell them anything they asked me, but I should preface my answer to explain to the listeners that everybody who went before the committee was vetted by staff members. If they didn't do that, if they didn't narrow it down to see what you were really good for when you came before the committee, those hearings could go on for 4 or 5 years. So they had to get down to the nub of it. And I didn't know that tapes was even on their mind. It had not been in these earlier interrogations that I had undergone over several years prior. So I was just up there to cooperate, and I assume to tell them more about the White House and the administration and how it's run, because I did run the administration at the White House as well. So, right out of the box, they showed me this, what looked to be a transcript, and I dealt with that. I did not tell them right away what I thought that was. I said, my gosh, where'd you get that? That looks very detailed and hemmed and hawed. And to my great relief, they got off the subject and went on with other things. Then eventually it did come out in that session. They finally asked a direct question, and I told them. So that was on Friday. Over the weekend, they felt that this thing's going to leak out. We've got to get it before the committee, the principals, the committee principals. And
we have a clip of that when you were put before the full committee in a nationally televised session. This is from July 16th, 1973, and we'll listen to Chief Minority Counsel Fred Thompson questioning you.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date. My guess, Mr. Thompson, is that the installation was made between, and this is a very rough guess, April or May of 1970 and perhaps the end of the summer or early fall 1970.
Are you aware of any devices that were installed in the executive office building office of the president?
Yes, sir, at that time.
Were they installed at the same time?
They were installed at the same time.
So, Alex Butterfield, how did you feel after you revealed the existence of the Watergate tapes?
Well, I didn't. That was a bad time for me. It really was. Over the weekend, I was hoping I would not have to go before that committee on Monday. When I learned at 11:30 that morning that I would have to go on at 2 o'clock, I suppose I could have refused. I think you're given 24 hours if you're subpoenaed. So in a way, I went voluntarily, but I knew what was coming down now. I had given the information on Friday afternoon. I hoped I wouldn't be called. I was off for the Soviet Union at 6 in the morning on Tuesday. I didn't want to get involved in this because I had no role to play, I didn't feel. And I knew it was serious business. I knew a lot of things that had gone on there in the White House. So, and plus, that I knew it would be embarrassing to our country because all these great leaders, heads of government and chiefs of state, had been eavesdropped on, not eavesdropped, but had been taped in our president's office. So it was a moment of deep concern to me, and yet I knew I was trapped. I knew what was going to happen. I knew that this would be the end of my short political career.
Why didn't Nixon destroy the tapes?
Well, I do know the answer to that. He didn't destroy them because while he could, he was absolutely certain that he would win. The White House wins almost always. And you just take a hard line and you don't give up. And,
you mean by refusing to turn them over?
Yeah, just refusing. And they were very, very important to him. So it was their importance and the fact that he had faith that he had confidence in that we would win this battle because they were his. They were his tapes. That's the way he felt. He was convinced of that. Then it was suddenly too late. I mean, if you now destroy it, you would be clearly guilty of burning evidence.
Tim Naftali, who is the former director of the Richard M. Nixon Library and Museum, is with us. And you had some background to add to this, Tim.
Yes. Well, I'm for the Nixon Library. Well, the Nixon Library is run by the National Archives, and I was the first federal director. It had been a private institution. And in 2007, we took it over, and I was asked to redo the Watergate exhibit and make it nonpartisan. One of the things we did was we set out and did some oral histories. I did one with Alex Butterfield. Some members of the Watergate Senate Select Committee told me that they knew to ask about the taping system because some Johnson veterans had told them that Lyndon Johnson had a taping system. So they thought, well, if Lyndon Johnson had one, maybe Richard Nixon had one. So there was some background from Johnson people that helped frame the question that Alex Butterfield received unexpectedly. The second bit of background I wanted to provide is that Richard Nixon was not alone in assuming that the tapes were his. He was the sixth president to tape, Franklin Roosevelt being the first. all presidents owned their papers and their tapes. Our country in that period allowed presidents to control papers the way the Queen of England controls her papers. They were not federal. They were not public papers. Presidents sold their papers at the end of their lives, or their families did. That was national, U.S. national tradition. So for Richard Nixon to assume that he could do with it what he will, what he wanted to with the paper, with the tapes, was perfectly natural. In fact, in 1973, when Mr. Butterfield testified, not only did the American people learn that there was a Richard Nixon taping system, but for the first time they also learned that there had been a Johnson system and a Kennedy system and an Eisenhower system and a Truman system and a Roosevelt system. All of that had been secret to the American public before Mr. Butterfield's testimony. So it didn't just affect our understanding of Richard Nixon, but our understanding of six presidencies.
That's right, but it took them a little while to come around. They didn't admit all of this the very next day. It took a couple of weeks, and they dribbled in these admissions.
Now, Nixon's tapes are the largest. They're an ocean, nearly between 4,000 and 5,000 hours of material. But the other presidents did produce quite a lot. There are 800 hours, for example, of LBJ tapes.
Alex Butterfield, what was your relationship like with President Nixon after you gave this testimony?
There was no relationship. No, seriously, from that moment on, I was very clearly out in the cold. I could feel it. In fact, there was a meeting at the White House several days. Well, I guess it was a week later, because I went to the Soviet Union the next day and I got back 3 weeks later. But there was a meeting of sub-cabinet members, and it was clear. No one wanted to be seen talking to me. And the Republicans were very clearly, the hardcore Republicans were very clearly down on me. And interestingly, a lot of Democrats were down on me as well, because they thought that this was probably a trick, a Nixon trick coming down later that they didn't quite understand. But why would this guy Butterfield, who worked so closely with Nixon for 4 years, whose office adjoined Nixon's office, do this terrible thing to the president? Well, I didn't mean to do any terrible thing. I just simply answered a question asked of me, and that was just my fate.
You chose to tell the truth.
Yeah, oh yeah, I did.
Tim Naftali, are these tapes part of the Nixon Library? Can people hear some of this?
Indeed. Well, they are the responsibility of the Nixon Library as part of the National Archives. And when I was director, we put online those tapes we released. There is one more large release to come, which I hope the National Archives will make available this year. When I was director, we put we released over 600 hours of tapes, and we added another 200 hours that had already been released and put them online. So either at the Nixon Library website or at the Miller Center of Public Affairs, University of Virginia website, you can listen to Nixon tapes. What's very important for the American public to understand is that they own these tapes. Richard Nixon changed the way we treat American presidential records now. They're public records, but that was Richard Nixon's achievement, Watergate's achievement, if you will. I wanted to add one other point, which is that Richard Nixon did ask somebody to destroy the tapes. He did ask Alexander Haig to destroy them. Alexander Haig told us at the library, and that's available online if you want to watch that, or it's available in the Watergate exhibit at the museum. And Al Haig said, no, I won't do it. I won't jeopardize my family. I won't put my family in legal jeopardy. Find somebody who has no national responsibility to do it. Ask your valet, Manolo Sanchez, or somebody else to destroy them. I can't. Well, Richard Nixon had pneumonia. He was in the hospital. He wasn't well. And by the time he got out of the hospital, it was too late to really do anything about the tapes. Already it looked as if there would be a subpoena from the Senate or from the Watergate Special Prosecution Force. And as Alex mentioned, once there was a subpoena, destroying the tapes would have put you in jail. So Nixon probably had about 3 days to make up his mind, but he was too sick really to do anything. And the one person he asked to do something, Alexander Haig, said no.
We're under a minute. Very quickly, what is the lesson of Watergate?
The tapes made the big difference. I don't think if the tapes hadn't existed, I don't think Richard Nixon would have been forced to resign. I think so. In the many sense, the system worked because of the tapes, and we know about the tapes because of the man sitting to my left.
And that man is Alexander Butterfield. He was the deputy assistant to Richard Nixon who revealed the existence of Mr. Nixon's White House taping system. He has been our guest, along with Tim Naftali, the former director of the Richard Nixon Library and Museum. They're both taking part in a discussion tonight at the University of Pittsburgh called Watergate, Third-Rate Burglary or Historical Turning Point. It's booked to capacity, but you can find a link to a live webcast by going to our website at WESA.FM. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Coming up, we'll talk with one of the stars of the Book of Mormon when Essential Pittsburgh continues on WESA.